G'day and welcome to Two Rabbis in the Podcast. I am Mordechai Becher.
And I'm Yehoshua Karsh.
And we are presenting our weekly podcast on issues in Judaism and Torah that we are interested in, we think other people will be interested in. We did start last week an Israel update with Pini Becher, First Sergeant Major, but he was called back to reserve duty today, and so he will not be participating this week, but we hope that next week he'll be back from reserve duty, or he will give us an update from wherever he is, somewhere in Israel. So that's, we hope, next week. This week, we are talking about Midrash. We did speak about literalism in the Torah a couple of episodes ago, and we are now speaking about literalism, symbolism in Midrash. So, Rabbi Karsh, what is Midrash? How significant is it?
Right. So before we dive into the text, I just wanted to make it clear from both of us that we consider the experiences we've had learning Torah through via Midrash to be amongst the most profound Torah that we've learned. And we both, in our formative years, had a chance to spend many years studying with Ramosha Shapiro, bless his memory. And he made it, he shared it with us. You know, he shared the profundity of the lessons learned from Midrash and Agadata with us, as he did with everything else. We heard daily shear from him. His reputation oftentimes was his brilliance when it comes to Machshava, but we heard Gemara share from him every day, and that included everything that Gemara involved. But he definitely helped us, gave us tools, and helped us see the beauty and the wonder that learning Torah via Midrashim allows. And it's the deepest of deep, and it's the most, you know, wonderful Torah. We are going to be talking about how to approach it to some degree. And it may seem to some that the way we're talking about it, that somehow we think Midrash should not be taken as seriously as it is. That's extremely, extremely far from what we're trying to say. It's the opposite. What we're trying to show is that when Midrash is studied incorrectly, that it makes the deeper message impossible to receive, and it makes it harder to get to the profundity that the Midrash is providing. But there was a thought that came to me this morning when I was thinking about this, which is I remember when we were in Mishkan Torah and Rabin Siam Brook used to come speak to us. There were particular times when he spoke where he had all of us enraptured. There was absolute silence in the room. He was over 90 years old, and he was teaching us at the time, and it was just so powerful. And there'd be times where he didn't do much more than read Agadata. He might have, in other words, there might have just been a Midrash or an Agadata. But somehow, as he was sharing it with us, it even just in the nuance of how he was presenting to us, it was so riveting, and it was so powerful and so impactful. So I just wanted to make that statement before we go on to talk about
Well,
possible ways of misusing or misrepresenting Medrash that we think it's so deep and so profound.
yeah, I'm happy you said that. And in fact, the reason that we are talking about Midrash and how to study it and understand it, etc., is because it is an integral part of Torah transmission. Because of its depth and profundity, it is important not to distort it.
Yes.
And it's also, I think, important not to miscategorize it. So, for example, if someone, and I've had this happen numerous times, person will say, but doesn't it say in the Torah that? And I will tell them, actually, no, it does not say that in the Torah. In the text of the five books of Moses, in the Chumash, that is a midrash. And there is such a thing as pshat, which is the unpacking the meaning from the text. Lifshot means to unpack, means to spread out something there. And there's such a thing as midrash, which is an expansion of the text, an expounding of the text, but it should not necessarily be confused with pshat. And I think that's something which people miscategorize things. I just remember, it's not directly related, but it's a story that has, it's an incident that stays in my mind. About when I first moved to Passaic, it was probably over 20 years ago, 23 years ago. So I was in a Judaica store. It was right before Hanukkah, and I was buying wicks and oil. And there were some other customers in there, also religious Jews, and a person walked in who introduced herself to us as a reporter for a local newspaper in New Jersey. And she said, "What is the significance of this festival, Hanukkah?" So I was about to talk about the Maccabees and the restoration of Jewish sovereignty over Israel for over 200 years, which is what Maimonides, the Rambam, says straight up, number one. The manifestation of God's love for the Jewish people through the miracle of the oil, our defeat of the Hellenists who tried to assimilate us. I didn't get any of that out. Why? Because someone, another gentleman in the store, I use that term very generously, interrupted and said, the significance, he says, we have a day of judgment called Rosh Hashanah. And that's followed by Yom Kippur, where there's a sealing of the judgment. And he says, and then we have Hoshana Rabbah, where the judgment, there's a second chance to change that sealed judgment. Hanukkah is the final time that we repent and have that sealing of the judgment from Rosh Hashanah, which there are sources that indicate that that may happen during Hanukkah. But if some person from a newspaper asks you, what's the significance of Hanukkah? I think most normal individuals would not say what this guy said. I'll give you his real name later. But anyway, God forbid, but I don't know his name anyway. But most normal people, so he's got this distortion in his mind of what's pshat, what's simple meaning, what is homiletics, what, and that's very important. So yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. And yes, thank God, Rav Moshe Shapiro did not skip Gemaras. So if there was an agadata, meaning a non-legal component of the Gemara, not illegal, but non-legal. He would explain that with the same depth, with the same effort, and the same passion, and the same profundity, and the same attempt to keep it in line with the totality of Torah as he did with every other section of the Gemara. And I know a number of his books have been published, a number of his shiurim have been published on this. Someone recently, I think Rabbi Hartman's, Josh Hartman's son, Rabbi Yeshua Hartman's son, I believe, published Rav Moshe's classes on some of the strangest Agadata, Rabbah Bar Bar Chana in Bava Basra, which always puzzles people. And it's a thick volume, covers a few pages of Talmud. And it's heavy stuff. And it is based on an in-depth view. So having said that, I want to start. I'm not going to read the whole thing out, but there are sections that I think are important. And the Rambam, and is really what we've just said, Rabbi Karsha's intro and what I just said, are echoed in the Rambam, Maimonides, in his commentary on the Mishnah. And he says, excuse me, I've got to wear my reading glasses. So this also adds
IQ points. I think it's awesome that you apologize. I think it's awesome that you apologize about
it. Okay, I'm just... Okay.
Is that just because of the surgery going forward, or did you always apologize?
I never apologize because I wore glasses all the time.
Right. Okay. So now you have to apologize because you only...
Yeah, I don't know why I have to reading. Do that. Yeah, I don't know.
I actually remember when Ramosha first started using glasses. I also remember that he would make light of it. I think you're following in his footsteps.
Yeah, maybe. I picked it up from him.
Yeah, but I think you should get those ones that are half.
I'm thinking of it.
The half moon ones, because it'll add a bit to.
Yeah.
Not that you don't have dignity already. You do have dignity.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
He says this. There are three groups of people in their attitudes to the Midrashim of the sages. The first group, and those are the majority of people I've met, this is Maimonides talking, he says, the majority of people I met and people who I've seen write about this in their works on Judaism understand Midrashim and Agadata kapashtam at their surface meaning. They don't explain them at all. As far as they're concerned, things which are physically, scientifically impossible for them, they are absolutely possible. He says, and the reason these people do this is because they are foolish and distant from any knowledge of science. He says they don't have, they're very distant from perfection, that so distant that this doesn't even bother them. That and they see these statements of the sages. They don't look for anything deeper in them other than what they, on their superficial level, understand. And he says, this group, Mesakenet Rachmanut al Sichon, this group is, we should have compassion on them because of their foolishness. He says, but because they think that they are exalting the sages, but the rabbi said it, so it must be exactly as it is written. He says, they think that they're exalting and honoring the sages, whereas in fact, Einam ela mashpilim otam betachlis hashiflut. They are debasing the sages with the ultimate debasement. And by the life of God, he makes an oath. This group, ma'abdim hadar ha-Torah, they destroy the honor of Torah. Machshichim zohara, they darken its light. Va'osim Torah Hashem, beheifach ha-mechuvaman, they do the exact opposite of the intention of the Torah of God. Because God said regarding his Torah that people will hear the Torah and they will praise it. And they will say, Rak am chacham v'navon ha-goy ha-gadol hazeh, how wise and understanding is this great nation. And now I'm quoting from the Rambam. He says, these people, what they do is they understand when they take the words of the sages on their superficial literal level, im yishmuna amin, if people, non-Jews, hear about this, yomru, this is what they'll say, rak am sichel v'naval hagoy hakatan hazeh, how stupid and ignorant is this insignificant small nation. And he says many of the people who give classes and droshes, sermons based on this, if only they will be quiet, he says, then they'd be wise to keep their mouths shut. So that's the first group. And I've got to say, unfortunately, I have encountered that many, many times.
As have I.
Okay. So that group, the Rambam, you could say, mildly, is very much against, condemns them. The second group, the Gam Haim Rabim, there are many of them, not as many as the first group, but there's many. When they see the words of the sages and they understand them literally, they think that that's what the sages mean, and they therefore will now make light of the sages. Yal igu al divrei chachamim, they'll make fun of the words of the sages. And they think themselves as having greater understanding than the sages, that they are more enlightened than the sages, and they feel that the sages didn't understand reality, didn't understand sciences, didn't have logic, etc. And they will, these people, he says, are or also, you know, yoter sichlim, they are more foolish than the first group. Because the first group at least has trust in the sages. And at least they have some level of faith in the sages, etc. This group, they're even worse. He says they are an accursed group. And he says, because we know the wisdom of the sages of the Talmud. And anyone who studied the arguments and the discussions in the halachic legal portions of the Talmud will be impressed by the depths, the logic, and the knowledge. So it's the same rabbis who on the next line or next page said something which you say, what a fool. He says, obviously, not illogical, but okay. The third group, he says, and they, and again, he takes an oath, they are so small, few in number that it's virtually impossible to call them a group. We're talking about individuals. He says, they are, thank God, I think because of people like Reb Moshe Shapiro and Yibod Lachaim Toivim, Rabbi Hartman, and for instance, people like Rav Hutner and the Maharal and so on and so forth. That group, I think, is a little larger maybe today than it was at the time. I don't know for sure. We don't have hard data on this. But he says, they are people who it is clear to them the greatness of the sages and their incredible understanding of reality. And he says they understand that the sages spoke in ways that concealed the real truth, that it requires effort. They spoke in chida and mashal, in riddles and in metaphor. He says, and that is the way of great, great sages to do so. And we know, and he goes on a little bit of a tangent here, but he says it would not be wrong for us to understand their words in accordance with what we know in logic, science, and so on and so forth, because they did not mean these words to be understood literally. They understood them, they presented these as mashal, they presented these as metaphor, as allegory. There's a difference, I don't know, but okay. They presented them as metaphor, allegory. I've never metaphor I didn't like. Indeed, that is how they spoke. So that's Maimonides. Right. And that's, you know, you can see these groups today as well. These three groups, those who belittle the sages, that's group two. Those who think they are giving honor to the sages by taking everything literally, whereas in fact, they are doing the exact opposite, degrading, humiliating, and putting the Torah out there for people's derision. And the third group, those who understand that the sages spoke in a way which is a very brilliant way of teaching, because why do they speak this way? Type of interesting. You know, you may have opinions about this, right? But I was thinking, because if you give a story which sounds wild, people remember that. Remember that. And if they remember that, they'll remember the verse that you attached it to. And you never, so on the lowest level, at the very least, the person will hear that and will say, and he'll remember the verse that they're discussing. At least he'll remember some idea, because the story, someone on a bit of a deeper level will understand this allegory of that story. Maybe just a one level allegory. Someone even more advanced will understand from the language something even deeper. So you've been able to present one idea, but that can be understood on many different levels.
Can I give an illustration of the first two levels that you mentioned? There's a Sherlock Holmes story called The Musgrave Ritual. Now, this story, he's telling Watson about something that happened before they ever met. It was when he was going to school. He was, I think, at Cambridge, fictionally. He went for the winter holidays with a friend. This friend were he was from a family of gentry, and they lived in a house that their family had lived in for hundreds of years. And he was, treated well as a guest, and it was very, comfortable surroundings. People were very nice. At one point during the holidays, they gathered together and they did something which was their Musgrave ritual. They had a ritual that was performed every year for hundreds of years. This ritual was performed by the living members of the family. And they each had their part, and it was a kind of choral reading. One person would read one part, another person would read another part. There was drinking, it was jolly. They were all having fun, and each one is reading their part. Now, Sherlock Holmes is not part of the family, so he's the audience and he's listening. And at one point, it becomes clear to him that this is a treasure map. That they have, this family has been telling this over year after year for generations and generations, for hundreds of years, as they were doing in front of him, not realizing that the contained within that, all the parts together, was a treasure map, which he then remembers the clues and he goes and follows it, expecting to find some kind of treasure, which apparently there had been, but somebody got there beforehand and was murdered. And then the game was afoot, Watson. But the notion, it reminded me sort of like the Pesach Seder, where you have all these people, telling over their various parts from the Pesach Seder, going for, for thousands of years, people are saying these words, and right beneath the surface are these treasures, but they are somehow preserved, as you're suggesting, they're preserved in the story. So even if this generation doesn't get it, and I guess you could say that first group, at least they're preserving the story. They
Yep,
are,
there you
they're
go.
not allowing you to get any deeper. You're never going to get to the treasure because, according to them, there's nothing deeper than the words themselves. And they stand like protecting you from getting to any deeper thing, as if it's heresy for you to even imagine that there's something deeper held inside of it. But meanwhile, beneath the surface are these treasures, which the clever person, the third group, which recognizes that these are riddles. Now they're trying to solve the riddles. And as they're off to solving the riddles, they are themselves finding themselves suddenly face to face with these deep, profound truths that are not afforded them by the first group, who says, there's nothing deeper to look here. You just have to take this whole thing as nothing more than an exercise of faith and just say the words, but God forbid that you should think that there might be something deeper to look at here, and that I have to trust my instinct that there's more to this than first meets the eye.
It's interesting. The first group, which the Rambam is addressing, which you're talking about, that's a group that thinks that their religious devotion is greater than the group who is thinking and looking into it, etc. They say, you people are, that we're the ones who take the words of the sages
You're
at face
heretics.
value, and they look at you as a heretic. And Maimonides is saying, these people are destroying the prestige of Torah. They are concealing the truth of Torah. They are concealing the light, and it's exactly right. So that absolutely, it's fantastic. It's a beautiful midrash, a fantastic mashal, a metaphor for that first group. The second group, type of interesting. There's a book called The Musa Movement by Rabbi Dov Katz, and on page 301. 202 in the notes. He's got a story about Professor Hermann Helmholtz, who was a German philosopher, who was talking apparently to Rabbi Yisroel Salanter, who was the founder of the Musar movement. And Professor Helmholtz was very shocked by the Talmud, which he felt is built on such solid and logical foundations, why does it contain legends which sound like fanatical and outlandish fantasies, such as the stories of Rabba Bar Bar Chana in Bava Batra? So Rabbi Yisroel Salanter, you know, they were living in this story happened in 1871. Germany had just won a great victory over France, as usual. And, in the apologies, we'll have an apology to France. Okay. Anyway, so apparently the King of Prussia had just been crowned Kaiser of all Germany. His emblem was a double-headed eagle. Sorry, previously it was one-headed. When he now took additional territory, it became a two-headed eagle. And there was a poem written, and it was printed in a newspaper, which said, "The great German eagle has one head reaching to Memel and the other to Metz. Its one wingtip touched Kiel and the other touched Badensee." So Rabbi Yisroel Salanter said to Professor Helmholtz, if someone would read that poem in 500 years, what would they think about the poet? He's seeing a double-headed eagle, which stretches over 1,000 miles in wingspan, whose beaks reach this you would think he's smoking something. That's not Rabbi Yisroel Salanter said, but he says, however, you and I, knowing the historical context, knowing the symbolism of the eagle, knowing the symbolism of the two heads of the eagle, knowing the symbolism of the wings, and the fact that Germany just won this war, for us, this makes perfect sense. He says, and he said to the professor, wouldn't someone in 600 years express the same opinion that you expressed about the sages of the Talmud? Would they not express the same thing about this poet? I think they would. And he gave another example that there was a newspaper headline that spoke about the Tsar has just drowned millions in a few drops of ink. You and I know that referred to the signing of the decree of the Pale of Settlement, Jews crowded into areas that were not sustainable economically and agriculturally in order to destroy the Jews and to oppress them. So he drowned millions with a few drops of ink. So again, this is normal human speech. And on the contrary, you know, we use this type of stuff all the time when we speak. If you say, oh man, he's got a good head. That guy has got a good head. I don't mean that he headbutts people effectively. I mean, he's smart, a smart person, right? And if you want to describe someone as being an idiot, you'd say he's got a thick head. Now, that might mean he can headbutt someone well, right? But thick head, in other words, these are metaphors and one does not take them literally. And I do remember that in your book, Musings of a Jewish Soul. What is it you said about the dog in Musings of a Jewish Soul?
That if there was ancient wisdom that said that if you point to something for a dog, the dog stares at your finger. It doesn't stare in the direction that you're pointing. That the whole purpose of pointing is to give direction for the person's gaze. But if somebody doesn't understand the purpose of pointing, they just keep on staring at your finger. And that people who are insisting that you have to read the Midrash as is written without being willing to look deeper, that you have to take it as it appears on the surface, are doing the same thing. They are staring at the finger and they're not looking where it's pointing. This is the scary part, I think, for a lot of people about Medrash. The scary part for a lot of people is that it involves you. It involves me. In other words, I have a role to play in finally, discovering whatever it is, the Torah. It's a discovery process. I'm looking over here in the direction that I'm being pointed, and at some point I'm going to go, oh wow. And it's a process of discovery. But there's nobody there. There's nobody standing alongside of me that's going, yes, that's exactly what you were supposed to assume. Now I have to, of course, I'm going to share it with others, and I'm going to look in other places to find, you know, more depth to it and corroboration of it. But the process itself is it's me. I've been taught that I can't trust me. I have to just read. I have to read what it means. Do not even, I know a lot of people, when they learn a Gemara, they don't even pause. They learn the Gemara, then they look to Rashi. They learn the Gemara, then they look to Rashi. They learn the Gemara, then they look to Rashi. There's never a moment where they're left alone to think about what this might mean, as if there is some kind of concern. And I've actually had this conversation with young scholars who are talented young scholars, who, when I've had this conversation with them, have voiced the concern that if they're allowed to work it out on their own, they may come to some kind of heresy, that they don't trust themselves to have discovered it. I'm not even saying you discover it and then move on without, again, looking. Obviously, you're going to look at Rashi. Obviously, you're going to look at the other commentaries on the Medrash and whoever else is available for you to look for. Obviously, you're going to talk to your Rebbe about it and your friends about it afterwards. It's not that it remains lonely forever. But there is a moment of discovery, and that is personal. And you have to trust yourself to let that happen. And it's part of the process.
Yeah. I think you've hit the nail on the head, and at the risk of going into another area, but I think in our education system, there is not enough emphasis on people trusting themselves. But in the Torah, for example, an example of what you think is the ideal, and I think is correct. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, chapters of the fathers, the Mishnah says, "Yei beischa beizvad lachachamim, let your house be a gathering place for the sages. Hevi shoisa bet samo es divrayim, drink their words with thirst. Vehevi misabek ba'afar raglehem." Now that's usually translated as, "And you should sit in the dust of their feet." But mis abek does not mean sit. It would be, and it says ba'afar raglehem. So what does mit abek mean? Rav Chaim Volozhin, who was, as we know, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhin Yeshiva and student of the Gaon of Vilna, he writes in his commentary, Ruach Chaim, that he says mit abek is from the word he'avkut, struggle. Right, when Yaakov wrestled with the angels of Ya'avek Ish Imo, he struggled with the, right? So he says what it means is struggle at the dust of their feet, meaning at the dust of their feet with humility, but struggle with their words. And he says, in fact, and I'll quote, "Asur l'talmid l'kabel es divrei raboi im yesh lo kushyos aleihem." It is prohibited for the student to accept the words of his teacher if he has got questions. He has to ask the questions. And he says, and sometimes the truth is with the student. Obviously not in my case, but with other people, right? The truth is with the student. And he says, even if the student's not right, but from his question, it will... He says, just like a small twig can light a great fire, he says, so the question of the student can ignite a knowledge and an understanding and an insight. He says, the way of Torah study is to actually use your own mind and to be and to have some trust in your own thought. That, as you pointed out, you check it with other sources, and I will not make a halachic ruling unless I check with someone senior. But in terms of understanding, to ignore one's own mind, to ignore one's own subject, and yes, it's subjective. Everyone's subjective, which is fine. And that's actually something we pray for in our prayers. V'tein chelkenu b'tzoraseha. Give us our portion in your Torah. That means our portion. Everyone has a unique understanding. No two people understand something exactly the same way. So that's our portion. And it's very, you know, the Eidot Mizrach says simchelkenu b'toratecha, which means place our portion that we discovered here b'toratecha in your divine Torah. So that will be recorded as my understanding, this understanding, etc., which is very, very significant. I think that's, yeah, I think the psychology is that we've been trained, many people from a young age, not to trust ourselves, not to rely on our minds, and that seems to me to be against what Reb Chaim Volozhin is saying and what the Torah tells us.
And you can't do Medrash. You can't explore Medrash without at least in the beginning trusting yourself. I mean, you're looking for clues, you're trying to figure it out, you're exploring, and then you hit something. Rabbi Abraham J. Tursky has a story about a young man who got involved in drugs and eventually, I don't know if he was asked to leave by his family or he just sort of wandered away from his family for a couple of years. And then he got sober, and it was the first Seder that he was back with the family in several years. And they were reading Avadim Hayinu, after Manishtana, Avadim Hayinu. And at one point in Avadim Hayinu, it says that if Hashem hadn't taken us out of Egypt, we would still be slaves to Paro in Mitzrayim. So around the table, as you're encouraged to ask, people were saying, like, that's not reasonable that we would still be slaves to Paro in Egypt. But this young man who had been struggling with addiction for several years says, I know what it means. In other words, there is a kind of slavery that without Hashem's help, you will not emerge from it, and you will be stuck in it forever. He was reading the words, they're reading the words very literally, and he understood. And when he understood that, he understood it in the depth of his being, because that was a deep place. His addiction and his struggles with addiction, it's a very deep place. And if somebody asked him, what do you think about the Seder, after that experience, if somebody said, what do you think about the Seder? He would say, it's the deepest of the deep. It was talking to me exactly where I was, right? And he knew it, and it was. It was saying something relevant to him at that place, but it's not. If you're just reading the words,
not going to get there.
No.
You remind me of something which they say about the Gaon of Vilna, that when people would come to him for advice, he would read a posuk, he would read a verse from the Torah or prophets to them, and the person would get the feeling that that verse was directly addressing the question they'd just asked. Like, it's just, he'd read it to them, and it may have been his inflection and the emotion, I don't know, but they felt that was it, and it was talking to them right there. And when you mention Reb Ben-Tzion Brook, for those who do not know who he was the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the Yeshiva of Novardok, transplanted into Yerushalayim, and a very, very amazing individual. I remember when you and I went to visit him, he'd broken his hip. He was in his 90s, broke his hip, and I think he also had pneumonia. He was in hospital. And I won't go through all the details of that, but
it was, according to Mordechai, one of the most awkward moments of his life, that visit.
It was very awkward. Very awkward.
And he
we brought him
it all on me.
Well, I think it was your suggestion to buy him flowers, and the Rosh Hashiva of Novardok
with his son standing around,
who was also Rosh Hashiva. So we brought in the flowers.
They did not understand why
are we doing gardeners
to other men?
No idea.
It was before Shabbos. I just want to point out.
So they were very confused. But I remember asking him, How is the Rosh Yeshiva? How are you? And he said, Hoidul Hashem Kitov. Blessed be God, because he is good. He said, thank God, lying in bed with multiple medical issues, with greater enthusiasm, greater joy, greater passion than I've seen people say when they tell me they've had a child or their kid got married. It was unbelievable. It was like, it was the joy. So sometimes when he just read things, right, coming through his personality, you could feel it was speaking to you.
Yeah.
I remember once, I got to mention this again, not related, but of the many people that spoke at our yeshiva at Mishkan HaTorah, so Reb Benzion Brook was one, Reb Sholom Shwadron used to come pretty regularly.
Almost every week.
The great Maggid of Jerusalem.
Right? Yeah.
Unbelievable. So I remember once, it was right before Bein HaZman in vacation, and he takes out a siddur, it was just before Maariv. Before Maariv? I think before Maariv. He takes out the siddur and he starts reading. He says, Ki heim chayenu va'oirech yameinu. These words of Torah, they are our life and the length of our days. And we're sitting there, yes. Vehem nege yoimam v'layla, and in them we will engage day and night. And we're all sitting there, and he's reading it, and he looks up, and the silence, and he says, Shakronim! Liars! Liars! He's like, you know, it was like being slapped around them, right? He reads these words and everyone's, oh, such beautiful words. We will engage in them day and night. And then he goes, Shakronim, liars. And then he said, he quoted what the sages say about the Jews leaving Sinai. Ketinoik haboreach mi beis hasefer, like a child running away, running out of school. Chofesh. Right? So, yeah, sometimes people can just say three words, just read a quote and can touch you deep down. It was like unbelievable. So, you know, we were merited.
And that's part of that's part of what is there on purpose. I mean, those words were crafted. They are capable of eliciting that kind of experience or inviting that kind of experience. And that is the case. It's like you're dealing with, even when you're, let's say you're dealing with an agadata, every word is crafted carefully. Everyone was thought out in order to take you to those places that you're able to go with able guidance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, you have to allow yourself to go there.
And you have to put yourself into it. Yeah,
you have to trust that you can go there. And also, I just want to mention what some people could do with a medrash, and it would still be wrong, which is you could open up, let's say you open up the Juggler and the King, which where Rav Aaron Feldman, it's a beautiful book by Rav Aaron Feldman, and it's about some of those stories from Rabbi Bar Barchanah. But then you could read that explanation and just, this was your whole experience. You saw the story from Rabbi Bar Barchanah. You read Rav Aaron Feldman's explanation based on the Vilna Gaon's commentary. And then that's it.
Nothing
you
further.
Still don't let yourself think about it. You still don't let yourself go anywhere. But now you think you've accomplished the third group. Now you think you're a member of the third group because you read somebody's explanation of what this deep story was. So now you're a member of the third group. No. All you did was read. You did the same kind of thing. You just took it one generation farther and you just read that. And now that's all you have.
Although it's certainly not from the first two groups.
No,
so I wouldn't go that far. Yeah. I would
it
say
is
such
not,
a person has not done violence to Medrash.
You have not, but you
may have,
still
he may have done a
not,
disservice to himself
that
in not going that far.
You haven't gone where
Correct.
They want you to go.
Right.
They didn't write it so you could do that. They wrote it so you could go and you could discover.
Which
you might
which
need help.
Is a great segue into the next source I wanted to just,
okay.
which is we mentioned, and this is agreed upon, that the Torah text itself, default position, literal.
Yeah.
Unless we have strong reason to say otherwise, as we saw Rav Sajagon and et cetera. Tradition, contradiction, logic, it's many, there are reasons. But the default position in the Torah is literal. What is the default position in Agadata and Medrash?
Nice.
How do we know? What is the default position? From what we've been saying, it seems that the default position, and the Rambam pretty clearly says this, is that it's not literal. So the Maharal brings evidence for this idea from a Gemara in Eruvin. Gemara in Eruvin, Samach Gimel 63a, talks about a student of Rebbe Eliezer who made a halachic ruling in the presence of his rabbi. Now, I should just point out that there's such a thing as a Rebbe Muvhak, meaning the rabbi from whom you learned most of your wisdom. It's not so common today, right? But you have someone who you could say, he is my rabbi. Now, I think it's pretty clear to most people that you're standing in his presence or nearby or something, we'll see, right? And someone asks a question and you give a ruling, a psak, in his presence that is the height of arrogance and disrespect towards your Rebbe. Absolutely inappropriate. Okay, so the Gemara says that this student did that. And Rebbe Eliezer said to his wife, Ima Shalom, interesting name, mother of peace, but okay. Anyway, Ima Shalom, he said to his wife, I'd be surprised if this guy lives out the year, which is, whoa, pretty shocking. So he says, I'd be surprised if this student lives out the year. And the Gemara says, in fact, he did die. He died within a year. And his wife said to him, what, you're a prophet? How did you know this? And anyway, he gives an explanation. And he said to his wife, I'm not a prophet, but I have a tradition that one who rules in the presence of his rabbi is liable to death in the hands of heaven. And then Rabbi Bar Bar Chana said, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, interesting, is Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. It just struck me. Yeah, okay, all right. Anyway, he says, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that the name of that student was Yehuda ben Giura. And he was actually quite a distance from Rebbe Eliezer. Nevertheless, he was struck dead. So the Gemara then says, so now we've got this story. It's not a halachic story. It's an agadata. This student, the rabbi says, I'm surprised if he lived out the year. He dies. Conversation with his wife, right? I mean, there is a halacha in it, which is you're not allowed to rule in the presence of your rabbi. But and then the Gemara says this. The Gemara says, Shmo v'shem aviv lama. Why do you have to tell me the name of the student and his father's name? So Gemara says, Ela shalotomar mashal haya. So you should not say it's a metaphor. So the Maharal in Be'er HaGola, which is his monumental work on defending the rabbis, the oral tradition, the Torah, the Talmud, which I think I heard from Rabbi Hartman was based on written questions given to him by scholars, non-Jewish scholars in Prague. And his book is his responses to them, okay, which makes a lot of sense. But so he says that you see that Atatira Kirov Divrehem, the majority of the words of the sages in the area of Agadata and Medrash, who Huberderech Mashal Umelitzas HaChochma, they are either as allegories or Melitzas HaChochma, or a wise expression. And the proof is from this Gemara, because the Gemara is saying this. Why does it give me this information? So you shouldn't say that it's a metaphor. Implication is, in the absence of this information, what would be your default position? It's a metaphor. And that is the Maharal's proof for this idea, again, in line with the Rambam, with Maimonides, which is not always the case, Maharal and the Rambam, but it is. And it's interesting, there's a tshuva of the Gaonim, which is Tshuvas HaGaonim HaChadoshos, and there's other sources in the Gaonim. Rav Hirsch, there's an amazing letter from Rav Hirsch, which we were discussing before Shabbos, and in which Rav Hirsch points out that this is one of the reasons, and this is actually in the Gaonim, that there's a rule that we don't learn halacha from Agadata and from Medrash. You do not derive halachic rulings from a Medrash or a Agadata. Now, it could be there are customs which are based on them, which is fine, right? But as a definitive halachic ruling, we don't do it. And one of the reasons given in the Geonim, and Rav Hirsch echoes this, I think he even quotes them, doesn't he? I don't remember. Which is that you can never really have certainty. Leika, where is it? Urcha de perusha livrure tchila. He says it's very, you have to be, first of all, clear on the explanation of the statement if you want to derive a halacha from this. And he says, and therefore, you have to understand, Kadmavara, he says there are certain statements in which the rabbis are saying, lav al pshate imruha, they're not saying it for its literal meaning, ela b'toras mashal v'dimui, but as a metaphor and a comparison. Limshol ertadvarim, to make something understandable to us, like the Torah itself does, which we discussed in a couple of podcasts ago, Dibra Torah Beloshem B'nei Adam. So he says that's one of the reasons we cannot necessarily derive halacha from that. And you know, you see that it's this is not something which is a shocker. Like, just for example, there's the famous story in the Gemara of Pinchas ben Yair, who is going with his donkey to redeem captives, and he comes to a river, and it's called the Ginai River. I remember Rav Moshe talking about this in the Shir. It was on Chulin. So he comes to the river and he says to the river, okay, you need to split because I need to get through. The river says, well, why should I split? I'm doing God's will, definitely. You, maybe yes, maybe you'll succeed, maybe not. So he says, look, either you split or I'll decree that no water shall ever flow through you again. It's a great argument, right? And the river says, okay, right? It splits. He says, wait, there's a Jew carrying wheat for Pesach, I want you to split for him too, because he's doing a mitzvah. The river says, fine. Right? He says, wait. There's an Arab trader who's accompanying us. It's not appropriate that you should split for us and not for him. So split for him too. So Tosfot on the place says, just it's not like he not Tosfot doesn't stop bothering. They say Tosfos basically says, Shema could be Sar Shalyam Heshivlo, could be that it was the angel of the water of the river that actually was speaking to him, who was communicating with an angel, etc. Or he says, Inami, Rapinchas Haya Machashev Belibo, Shalakach Haya Meniach Melacha. Or it could be Rapinchas Ben Yor, this is the going on in his mind, what would be the conversation if I was talking to the river? Tosfos says this also regarding the famous case of Rabbi Eliezer Ben Durdaya. This Jew who was deeply, deeply embedded in licentiousness and sexual immorality, who repents, and in the course of his repentance, he puts his head down and he cries and he says, heavens and earth, beg for my mercy. And the heaven says, well, we're our own existence is shaky. And he asked the mountain. The mountain says, Tosfot right there says, oh, either that was the angel, the force, the spiritual force behind it, or in his mind, he was thinking that. And you find the Rishonim say this many, many times. The Ritva, when he talks, when he talks about the Agadata of Rabba Bar Bar Chana, he says that no doubt there are amazing, massive creatures in the sea, whales, etc. He says, when the sages saw these, then they may have gone to sleep. And these images, in their mind, they now had these other visions attached to that, and they explicated them when they woke up and tried to communicate messages through them. So we have the Ritva, we have Tosfos, we have the Rambam, we have the Maharal, we have the Geonim. One more source, which is the Vikuach of the Ramban. Nachmanides was forced to debate Pablo Cristiani back in Castilla in front of King Philip of Aragon and presently is King Philip. Okay.
This is your area of specialty, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I know.
This exactly the era for which you are a master.
King James of Aragon. And in the course of the debate, Pablo Cristiani's strategy was to use the Jewish sources to prove that his Christian Messiah was the Messiah. He says, I'm going to show you from the Gemara. So, okay. So he brings one of the pieces of evidence he brings is the Gemara that says that that he was born, the Mashiach was born when the temple was destroyed. So Pablo Cristiani seems to think that the closest person to that was Jesus, and obvious, right? So the Ramban gives a few answers. He says, A, it doesn't say the Mashiach came then. It says he was born then. So Pablo Cristiani says, are you telling me that he's not yet come, but he was born 800 years ago, 1,000 years ago? And the Ramban says, stranger things have been said in the name of faith. Just a little bit of a subtle dig. He says, secondly, I understand that as meaning that the redemption is created in the midst of destruction. God gives the cure in the middle of the disease or before the disease. God creates the light of hope in the midst of darkness. It's a metaphor. It doesn't mean literally he was born then. And he says, and third, he says that is from the section of the Talmud that we call Agadata. And hence it's actually interesting. He says there are two parts of the Talmud. He says, Yesh lanu shlosha minim shel svarim. We have three types of books. He says, number one, we have the Bible, five books of Moses, the prophets and the writings. We all believe in that, emunah shlema, absolute belief. Secondly, we have the Talmud, which is the explanation of the mitzvahs, the commandments of the Torah. And he says, because there are 613 commandments, there's not a single one that is not explained in the Talmud. He says, and we believe in those explanations of the performance of the commandments, absolutely. He says, we have a third, which is what we call Midrash. Rotzeh lomar, sermons. That's in the transliterated in the Hebrew transcript. That is to say, he says that if someone stands up and gives a sermon, and he wants to inspire people, that's what it is, sermonic material. So now here there's a huge debate. Was the Ramban saying this because as a form of polemic that this was his, he needed to defend himself against Pablo Cristiani, or did he really believe this? This is debated by historians and scholars, etc. But the Ramban, in that debate, he actually says, if you accept that, wonderful. If he doesn't believe it, it won't hurt him. Now, what does he mean here? He says, I don't know. It's hard to know what the Ramban means, but maybe what he means is that if you don't believe that in its literal, if you don't believe that in its literal sense, no problem. I don't know if he's saying reject it completely, because a sermon, if a great rabbi would give a sermon and I just say, I don't believe anything he said, I think that would be wrong. You say, well, I don't think he was meant literally. That wouldn't be so bad. Right? So that's, and I think there are many classic examples of this where we look at something and the Maharal will come along and say, I know the kids sometimes are taught in school, these things are literal. The one that comes to mind, I think we have to finish soon, but the one that comes to mind, oh, and by the way, those who are expecting the Israel update, so my son Pinny, who gave it last podcast, is currently, did I mention that before? Yeah.
You did mention.
Okay, because it's on my mind. Okay, so he's in reserve duty, so he won't be joining us this week. In any
case, it's on all of our minds, and Hashem Yishmor. Hashem Amen. Should protect him, along with all the other people.
All the soldiers and the hostages.
Yes.
And so the classic case that says that, that when Moses took his wife and kids to Egypt, he says he put them on the donkey. Rashi points out, what do you mean, the donkey? Put him on a donkey. He says, there's a donkey that is previously mentioned, and there's a donkey that's mentioned in the future. The donkey previously mentioned is the donkey on which Avraham took his son Yitzchak, Isaac, for the binding of Isaac, the sacrifice. And there's the donkey upon which we are told, Zechariah, that the Mashiach, Messiah will come riding poor and on a donkey. Same yes. donkey. So now, granted, God could create a donkey that could live 5,000 years. Not a problem. Or whatever it is, 4,000 years. Not a problem. All right. I've seen cars in Israel that are like that. You know, you don't really held together literally by duct tape, and so people have had them since 1948. You know, it's like a Susita fiberglass. It's like there's bites taken out of it by a camel. And okay, so doesn't literally mean there's a, or do we have to? You know, so I think the Maharal explains that there's an idea that the donkey represents the physicality, materialism within each person. We all have our own donkey. Riding a donkey, guiding a donkey, indicates that I'm in control of the physical. Avraham showed the world that a person can control their deepest instincts. My free will can overcome. He's willing to take his son to the Akedah, to the binding, the sacrifice. Moshe is the one who brings Torah down to the world and gives us the precise GPS coordinates of where we should take that donkey, i.e. the physical, what we should do with it, how, the mitzvahs, etc. And the person or the time at which we will have a complete integration between the donkey and the rider, where the donkey will instinctively follow what the soul wants to do, where there'll be a unity between the physical and the spiritual, that's the time of the Mashiach.
Right.
It's a beautiful lesson. Obviously needs more. We could expand on that, but for the limits of our podcast, right? Just one example of something which is understood beautifully in a way that is not. You don't have to believe if you didn't. And I think that may be what the Ramban is saying. If a person says, "Like, I don't believe there was a 4,000-year-old donkey," I think it might mean something else. You're good. You're good. So maybe, but either
also,
way, what he actually says is quite more extreme.
About the sermon thing.
Yeah,
because let's say part of the process is that you're looking where the finger is pointing. In other words, you're reading a medrash and you're curious and you're starting to wander around a little bit, based on the guidelines of the medrash, you sort of wander around and then you believe you've seen something. In other words, you believe that this is what the medrash means. In other words, this is what the metaphor is. You're allowed to go there. In other words, you're allowed to say what you think it means. Somebody else might disagree with you. Like, so I could give a whole drasha, I could give a sermon on what I believe the point of that medrash is, and somebody could stand up and say, that's rubbish. And he, essentially what he's commenting on is not the medrash itself, not the starting point. He's disagreeing with my result. He's disagreeing, which he can do. And so there could be 100 different drashos given based on that medrash, and you may get 100 different viewpoints based on it. And there might actually legitimately be some that don't make sense and can't be because of this reason and that reason. But there also may be quite a few that represent a legitimate, point of view. That's only possible because the Medrash sort of gave directions and allowed somebody to see something from a vantage point. And that vantage point is legitimate. It deserves being shared. That this person has it. So even the Maharal, let's say the Maharal is explaining it to you. That's the thing I said before that about the juggler and the king. Even when the Maharal is saying it to you, that's not the only, you won't be worse off if this happens, but I'm just saying if you just say, well, the Maharal says this is what it means, and then that's what it means, that you're also not doing justice to that agadator, to those midrashim. The Maharal is a mentor to us on how to look at those. And obviously coming from him, it's a very weighty perspective, but it's not the process. He engaged in a process, he's modeling it, and we're also allowed to go there. And then again, check. with mentors. We always have to have mentors. We always have to have friends to talk about it with. And like happened a couple of weeks ago when Mordechai sort of shut me down about my questions about the Akedah possibly being a Nevuah, and when Rabbi Tatz did that to me a few years ago. That's why you have mentors, you know, you're and, yeah, you and friends, you. Yeah. And okay. then right. you okay. stubbornly keep on going at it and wanting to talk to them again about it from this point to that point. Okay. I will not let it go, but okay. it's, but I acknowledge the process and am learning each time somebody is bringing up issues with it. And even the very fact that people take issue with it, I acknowledge it. I recognize it. It may not cause me to just stop looking around. I once shared with Mordechai, with Rabbi Becher, that my theory, I have a theory that, when the Gemara says that you have to be 40 years old to learn Kabbalah and you have to have learned all the Nistar and all that other kind of stuff, right? So there is this, at least there is this assumption that that's what the Gemara means, that that until you've accomplished all of that, you can't learn Nistar. And then we find out that any Makuba worth his weight, was learning this stuff when he was a teenager.
So the Arizal passed away before he was 40.
Ramchal.
As did the Ramchal.
Yes. All these people were like 40. And clearly had been learning it. They bought the Vilna Gaon. He was like 13 and he was out there trying to make a
golem.
Yeah. A golem. So my theory is that if you're the kind of person that pays attention to those rules, Kabbalah is not for you.
I like that.
If there's a sign on a door that says do not enter and you've never opened one of those doors, this stuff is just not for you. But if you still got to be, you have to have, as you said before, we have to avak raglehem. We have to be humble. And especially this is the area where you need to have mentors. But you also have to fearlessly go out there and when discover.
No man has gone before.
That's what Medrash wants of us. And
yeah, I all right. Agreed.
Yeah.
Okay. So, folks, thank you very much for listening and watching. Subscribe, like, and tell your friends about this. Because we don't just want this to be, Rabbi Kash and I and our family.
I do. I mainly just.
Oh, he may. I'd like it to get a little bit of a broader audience.
I'm perfectly happy if it's just.
Okay. But. Goodbye and
be well.
Be well.
Be well. All right.